Let's talk with another fellow retirement planner, Lauren Hunt from Daybreak Wealth Management, in this, the 98th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Hello again, everybody. How you doing? Glad you're here. Thanks for listening as always. Today we have another fun retirement planner chat where I'm joined by a fellow practitioner in the retirement planning world. Today I'm talking with Lauren Hunt from Daybreak Wealth Management in based in Illinois. She and I had a great conversation. I'm sure you'll all get a lot out of it. And she has some really good framing and views and perspectives of how to think about things and approach things, which was really nice to hear and really insightful. And I agree with a lot of it. So I'm not just saying I like it because I agree with it, but I think she really does have a good way and approach and even sort of slightly different view, again, in a good way. Like, for example, one of the things she said about, I won't spoil this too much, but the question was, what is one area that many people spend too much focus or energy on in retirement planning? And she said tax planning, which was, I thought, was a great answer. So my background and sort of my world is heavy in the tax planning side, but she raises a great point. There's some people where you kind of approach it with almost too much emphasis, and you can get lost in the details and sort of lose sight of the bigger picture because you're worrying too much about trying to optimize to the nth degree something about IRMA or fill in a bracket or Roth conversions or whatever it may be. Not to say those things aren't important. All these things are important in a big plan, but it is quite possible and very common for some people to spend too much focus on that. And again, sort of lose sight of the forest through the trees or however that statement goes. So anyway, I'm not doing the conversation justice here trying to recap it, but I guess that's my cue to stop. So I will, without further ado, I'll stop yapping and bring you my chat with Lauren Hunt from Daybreak Wealth Management. Thank you, as always, for listening and welcome back. Today, we have another special guest, fellow retirement planner, Lauren Hunt. Hello, Lauren.
Hey, Andy. How's it going?
Super. How about yourself?
Great. Thanks. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I look forward to our conversation.
Likewise. I've been looking forward to this for a while. So maybe quick background intro. So again, your name is Lauren Hunt. Could you recap your firm name, where you are, what you do, et cetera?
Sure. So first and foremost, I'm a mom to three amazing kids. But professionally, my story started when I was a kid, actually. We used to take the train downtown Chicago, and our walk like into the city took us past the Board of Trade. So we would stop in and like watch the opening of the Board of Trade. Okay. And I was fascinated. I was like, I'm going to do that. And partially because I couldn't believe people were communicating that way in the open air pits at the time. So when I was in high school, I got a job clerking on the floor of the Chicago Stock Exchange. And I did that in high school and in college, like during the summer, super fun summer job. And then decided I didn't want to be a trader. So okay. I got my finance degree from the University of Illinois, did consulting for a few years, but ultimately missed the markets. So I worked at Citadel, the large hedge fund that was based out of Chicago, for 7 years before sitting in one of their lunch and learns where there was a CFP that they had brought in to speak to us. Mm. And she was talking and I was like, why am I not doing this? This is what I want to do. Right. And so I like approached her on the side and was like, how do I do what you do? So mm-hmm. She's the one who told me about the CFP program. So I did that, worked for another RIA or registered investment advisor for 7 years, became a lead advisor and their chief operating officer before founding Daybreak Wealth, which is my firm located in Hinsdale, Illinois.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
And is your business in person, virtual, mix of the two?
So great question. So I do work out of my office, but I'm seeing all of my clients virtually so that I can service my clients around the country. Okay. So I'm focused on working with what I call diligent savers who have accumulated somewhere between $2 and $10 million of net worth. Almost all of my clients are very near and preparing for the retirement transition. Mm-hmm. I work on a flat fee basis, very similar to yours. And when I built my practice, as I was transitioning into leaving my last firm and starting my new firm, another advisor had asked me, like, what's your definition of success? And like, through that question, I realized it wasn't working with 100 clients or managing $1 billion. Like, what I really wanted was to work with a very select group of people, very completely and holistically, and really be their trusted decision-making partner, you know, the person that they call up to think through all sorts of decisions that ultimately have financial ties. And so that's the practice that I've built, right? I have great relationship with my clients. They call me. I feel like we have great conversations back and forth. And, you know, it really does settle into like what is, I think it's better for them and better for me.
Right. And that's a common denominator amongst everyone I've chatted with so far on this podcast, like yourself, where we are all relatively smallish or small practices, but that's intentional. And we know our why and what we're seeking to build. And it's not these behemoth growth at all costs, just scale up to the gills and eventually sell it and tap out. It's like you want small, manageable, close connections with a relatively limited number of clients where there's a mutually meaningful impact and relationship both ways, right?
Absolutely. And I think what I learned, you know, as I've gone through my whole career path is that like deep relationships and holistic advice doesn't really scale, right? So if you really want to do those things and be present in your client's life, that way you have to commit and be okay with like capping your client base on some level.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that what you found too?
Oh, 100%. And for everyone listening, I'm paraphrasing what you just said, but something like holistic advice doesn't scale well. So anyone like those big household name firms where your advisors work with 100, 200 people, they're not doing real planning. They're, you know, it's probably just investment focused. They got you in some pre-canned model and they do some trading every now and again and talk with you and show you big flip books about performance returns and talk about economics, same stuff they're giving to everyone else, but they don't really know you well and really dig into the true planning. So that was a great quote. I forgot. I got this dad joke thing that I can't believe I didn't bring one up. So did you know that NASA is launching a satellite to say sorry to the aliens?
No.
No? They're calling it the Apollo G.
Oh, jeez.
Apollo. Yeah, that's so bad, isn't it?
Well, my husband is full of dad jokes. So maybe when he listens to this, he'll add this to his repertoire of like 5 jokes he repeats over and over again.
Oh, yeah, that's not my best work, but that's if it's in his top 5, great. But if he's interested, I can get him some better ones.
Awesome.
All right. So we already talked about, I was going to ask typically, you know, why you got specifically into retirement planning. Was that an intentional, that's the people and the sort of situations you liked, or that's just kind of how your practice fell out for whatever reason?
A little of both. But what I ultimately found in having the opportunity to work with a lot of different types of client as my last firm is I really love helping people like see what's possible with what they've done. I really like being leveraged as that decision-making partner. And it's really fun to watch them thrive on the other side, like once they do get comfortable with it. And so while there's a lot of life transitions, I've just found I can add a lot of value in this space, and I really enjoy helping people through this particular transition.
Yeah, same. I agree with everything you said there. All right, some general questions now about retirement planning. In your experience, what do you think is an area of retirement planning many consumers overlook or don't give enough consideration or attention to?
So I thought this was a really interesting question. And for me, the answer here is the soft skills part of retirement. Mm. So the idea that you have to retire to something and that, you know, people are, let's retire, very excited about it. But when you actually get to that point, the transition can be very intimidating. And I think a lot of people underestimate emotionally what that's going to feel like. And that doesn't mean it stops them from doing it, but I just don't think it's talked about frequently. And people think it's, you know, not common when in my experience, it's very common. So for me, it's the soft skills.
Okay, definitely. And on the flip side of that question, what do you think is an area that people give too much attention to many times?
And so I apologize in advance. For me, this one is tax planning. And not because tax planning isn't important. It is. People should do it. But to me, tax planning is one of the many levers. And I think it needs to be viewed holistically. And there's just a lot of articles on tax planning. So it is important. I just think it gets talked about more frequently than some of the other planning areas. And in my opinion, plans work best when you've incorporated all pieces rather than just one lever.
That's a great thought. I agree with you, actually. So, you know, my background, the podcast background is largely sort of tax focus is where we sort of hang our hat. And tax is obviously important and I think overlooked by a lot of advisors and people, but the pendulum can swing too far. And like, I work with people or talk to people where there's almost such wonks in the data and the numbers and the tax that they overemphasize, like, to the nth degree, trying to get that Roth conversion analysis just right, or you know, income projection or whatever. Again, to your point, important, but to lose sight of the forest through the trees or whatever that saying is, tax is one area where people can get lost. So interesting. Good view. When working with people that are single versus those in a couple, there's, you know, commonly different planning dynamics. What are some of the big things or opportunities or areas for concerns you come across in differences between single versus couples planning?
So in general, I think people are people and planning is planning. And so from my perspective, a lot of it is the same. What I have noticed in my practice is that single people have different stuck points than couples. And so when I end up working with people who are single, we spend a lot more time talking about, well, who's going to be my decision maker if something happens to me? Like, what's my long-term care plan? What am I going to do with my assets? Because maybe that natural, like, spouse, you know, some of the natural answers are either no longer an option or just aren't classically a fit for them.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, I would almost draw on one example. I'm thinking of a client I worked with who unfortunately had lost her husband, and she was well enough off. And what she was really struggling with was, who do I travel with? Like, I have this money, but, like, this plan we had isn't there. And so she and I ended up working out, like, what if you paid for a friend to come with you? Like, you have the resources, do it. Maybe you're, you know, so I feel like they just get stuck on different things, but people are people and planning is planning.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, it does. And almost every person, every scenario, they're going to have their own unique stuck points, to use your terms, right? And I guess there's probably more commonalities among stuck points amongst couples versus single for, you know, some obvious reasons, and I guess some situation-specific reasons, but good. And so I guess it takes some conditioning and sort of practice in dealing with different scenarios and people and, you know, life situations to know those stuck points and how to best help with them.
Right. And I kind of think that's where, like, when we jump back to, like, that holistic planning and, like, really getting to know your clients, right? So much of what we do needs to be tailored to, like, what does the client need and what are they really asking in this moment? And how do we help them figure out how to get where they want to go? Because I kind of view that as my job. They have an endpoint they want to get to. How do I help them get there with the resources they have and the tools that are available to us?
Yeah. I think that's financial planning in a nutshell is that, like, using resources available to help someone get where they want to go, right? Yeah. Every path will look very different and every outcome will be different, but that's it in a nutshell. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my view.
Boil it down. It is that simple, right? Boil it down. Now, obviously, the devil's in the details, but that's a great way to frame it. Do you think there are people who could or should do their own retirement and financial planning?
I absolutely think people can do their own retirement planning. When I was going through my CFP courses, there was a couple that was just retiring sitting in the classes because they wanted to do their own financial planning, right?
Yeah.
I think for me, the answer to this is really being honest with yourself about what your aptitude is, what your interest is to learn the pieces that you don't know, as well as if you are part of a couple, what is my spouse's interest and aptitude for doing and managing this? And then making a decision to hire or not hire, you know, based on that combination of factors. And I've actually seen people who are very interested, very capable, and very, you know, almost very self-sufficient at doing themselves hire someone like us because they know that their spouse would be completely overwhelmed in making that decision if something happened to them.
Yeah.
And I've also seen people who are doing it for a long time that just are like, I'm retired now and I want to travel and see my grandkids and I'm no longer interested, right? So to me, this is really about being honest with yourself about what you can do and what you want to do.
Yeah.
But absolutely, people can.
Right. The information is all out there. I've heard this and read this in multiple ways, like between Google and books and whatever. Every single thing you can want to know about every aspect of finances, taxes, life management, et cetera, is there. So if you have the capability and the aptitude and willingness and ability to do it, like, sure.
Yeah.
But I guess, like anything, you know, you can say that same is true about, like, auto mechanics or even like surgery, right? You know, medical things.
Yeah.
People should realize their bounds and or just say, I don't want to put the time and energy in to fully learn all this, fully implement it. It's something I'd feel better just hiring out. And that, you know, I guess same thing for advisors. So,
yeah. And same piece there is, like, you know, they change the rules regularly. So it's not something that you can just do once, right? If you choose to do it yourself, you have to be willing to like stay up to date and relearn.
Right.
As they adjust. Yeah, exactly. Definitely. But I agree with you. I think the mechanic is a great example.
Yep. I'm proud of myself. So I'm very mechanically inclined, especially like woodworking and building things. But cars are something I've always just stayed away from. A couple of years ago, I needed a new battery in my car. You know, I'm going to try to figure this out. So I went on YouTube, found a video for my exact model of car, you know, year and make of car. I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. You know, a couple socket wrenches and this little battery tender thing. And then half hour later and only one little shock to myself, I was like, okay, I figured it out. But you know, going forward, it's like, yeah, I can do this, but I don't think I want to. So going forward, if I need another battery, I'm just going to go to Pep Boys or something to get it done. But I learned
probably nice to know you
done.
Can do it. But like you found you weren't interested, right?
Exactly. For me, yeah. Not you. No. Okay. Understandable. So for now, for people that do feel they want or need an advisor, kind of broad question, but what sort of questions do you think they should ask? What should they focus on? Where should they look, et cetera?
So I think this is a great question. So you know, a lot of the stuff that you read everywhere, I think is true, right? They should, if you can find someone independent and credentialed, you know, who has, you know, a good set of baseline knowledge, I think that's really important. But the part that I don't see in the guidance to consumers about hiring an advisor is to really ask them to ask themselves, like, what do you want out of an advisor? Like, if I am the person who really wants to do most of it myself and then just looking for a quick check-in, well, maybe I need an hourly planner. If I'm someone who just wants someone to help me execute, you know, trades, like maybe I need a broker or do I, you know, so I think, and I guess I would almost use analogy, like you can research the best cardiologist in the world, but if you want a pulmonologist, you're not going to be happy with what you get, right? And so I think you just need to know what you're looking for. And then ask the person you're thinking about working with how they do that, how often they do that. Like, is that their traditional client? Right. And I think then you have a better chance of ending up with a fit.
Yeah. Yeah. This is hard. And I do feel for consumers because it's hard. Like, you don't even know where to start and you don't know what you don't know about what possible services and areas of focus are there amongst advisors, you know, and what they can provide. How do I go to find that? Like, there isn't a central searchable source. Even the term financial advisor means nothing. Like, that's a made up term that anyone can give to themselves, you know? And the difference between, to get too in the weeds, but insurance versus securities versus investment management versus financial coach. I don't know. Not to put you on the spot, but like if someone were to ask, where do I even start? And I'm just curious here because I don't have a good answer to that myself. Like, how would you attempt to tell someone where to get the basic education or where to start to coming up with figuring out what you think you need from a planner?
So that's a great question because I agree with you. As an industry, I think we have a definition problem, right? Like the way what we call ourselves isn't necessarily standardized in the way that, you know, somebody who has an MD definitely went to medical school, right?
Right.
So I think one of the, if I were telling a consumer, and it is overwhelming, like I agree with you, I would start places like the Certified Financial Planner, like database. I would look at the FPA, so the Financial Planning Association or NAPFA or other very large, well-accepted industry databases and search there. I do think you can get great referrals from other professionals that you know and trust. So I know, like, I work with my clients, I work with their estate attorneys and their insurance providers and their CPAs. And so if you have somebody there that you work with regularly and love, it could be another great place to start. And then my other piece of advice would be, like, don't be afraid to call and set up introductory meetings. And like so much of a successful relationship, in my opinion, is like my interaction with you as a client and your, you know, and your trust in me. And so see who you have a good conversation with. Call three or four of us.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So not to put words in your mouth, but it almost sounds like you're saying just because you run into someone at a wedding who knows someone who went to college with someone who knows a guy, that's not a good fit necessarily.
Yeah. Okay. But I do think that's how a lot of people pick planners, right?
Yeah, no, they do. It was like a kind of tongue-in-cheek joke. Like, unfortunately, I think that is a lot of the way people come across someone in the industry. They really have no idea who that person is or what they do. But hey, it's, you know, better than some random stranger off the street, I guess.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, but, you know, I guess that's the thought, is at least someone is vouching for the person, even if it's four people removed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Wish I had a better answer for you.
Yeah, no, as do I. And again, I really do feel bad for consumers because there isn't a great answer. And hopefully one day someone somewhere comes up with a more concise, sort of targeted, easy to use, centralized way to go about this.
Can I add one commentary on this? That actually, when I first got started in this industry, I would caution people to be careful of like the best lists. Often those are like paid advertisements versus an actual like third-party evaluation of people and their services. So that is one place I would tell people. It's not necessarily a bad place to start for a list of names, but I wouldn't take it as like a be-all, end-all in my search either.
That's no one's ever said that, and I'm glad you did. That's fantastic information, and I feel the same. Those things are largely popularity contests and or pay-to-play lists. I've personally been asked by people, hey, please vote for me to add me to this list type thing. And so I know lots of planners who are substantially better at what they do than a lot of these people on these top 40, top 100 lists. Not to say those people are bad, but those lists didn't affect me nothing. You know, I'll be blunt about it. So,
yeah.
Okay. Thanks for bringing it up. That's a fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, next one. This is one of my favorite questions, and I don't know why, but I get hung up on the quote-unquote value of what we do, and I sort of get a little too heated when some people try to say all the value can be quantified, especially when they say, you know, the value I'll deliver is at least two times my fee or whatever. There are some things that can be measured, but my view is there's a lot that aren't. So not to try to set it up for you and lean it too much in one direction, but what's your view on, can the value in what we all do actually be measured?
So I guess lucky for me, I agree with you. So I think value is really personal, right? And so if we use another analogy, right? Some people get a ton of value out of staying at the Four Seasons. Other people would consider that like a huge waste of money, right? But I think what if you feel like what you've gotten out of it, what you need, right? There's a lot of value there, right? The part about quantifying it is interesting to me, because I think to really quantify it, we would need to know what decisions people would have made without a planner, and that's nearly impossible. There are some pieces, sure, if you want to look at like trading execution and certain things where you could probably put small dollar quantifications on it. But largely, I think value is very personal to what the client is looking for, what they need, which parts, like what their stuck points are, right? If you go back to my client who, you know, we ultimately ended up with this great decision that she maybe needed to travel with a friend, like what dollar amount do you assign to that, right? Like to the comfort that came with like, we're over a stuck point. I just think there's places that we're helping people that don't necessarily have a traditional dollar value associated with it.
Definitely. The peace of mind value and the sleeping better at night value are things you truly can't put a number on and vary wildly from person to person. The value is real. It's just like you can't really pin it down and wrap a number to it.
But. Yeah. And actually, I think that's where I, like when I was starting my business and ultimately went to the flat fee, and I imagine this is true for you, right? It's not hidden. You know how much you're paying us. Like if that doesn't match what you feel like you're getting out of it, it's very easy to like for you to personally evaluate whether it's a fit, right? Like if you're trying to tie things back to dollars. So
yeah,
one of the things I like about the transparency of the fee models that we've chosen.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's important for everyone. It's know what you're paying in dollars. Like know all the outright costs, know all the hidden costs, and know it all in dollars, not just percentages. And then you at least know, okay, I'm paying X amount of dollars per year. Is it worth it to me? Don't expect that you're going to get a list of here's exactly what we did and here's a dollar value. Like that's not going to happen. At some point, you're going to say, I'm not really getting much out of this. Or you're going to say, this is truly invaluable. And I can't see me ever not having this advisor. And that's going to be different for everyone, but know what you're paying in dollars, because that'll help set the stage for realizing, you know, is this something you think is still worth it for you?
Absolutely. And I would add one more thing to that, that the value, at least in my experience, and maybe you can say if this is true for your practice, I feel like it comes in waves for people as they move through life. Like there's points that they need a lot of support and a lot of touch points. And then there's other points where they're more settled. And then, you know, they come back again as other transitions maybe happen later in life. And so I think it's important to look at the relationship as a whole. And like, for me, it's a personal pet peeve when people are like, well, what happened today or what happened tomorrow? It's about the long-term relationship and the long-term goals.
Yeah. That's another great point. And it's not just like trying to fleece people by saying that. It truly, unless you were to charge like truly hourly, which I don't think would work for various reasons, but to your point, there's going to be years where someone's actually leaving the workforce to retire. There's big decisions to be made around pension, social security, rollover, et cetera. There may be a lull for a bit. And then who knows, you may be selling a house, buying another, or, you know, God forbid, a health event or death in the family event. So it definitely comes in waves, and view the fee as stretch it out over the life of the relationship. Some years you're getting more for it than other years. But if you approach it as, well, show me exactly what you did for me with every hour this year, or, you know, every deliverable, that doesn't make for a good relationship. And both parties are going to struggle to find that acceptable. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like that bigger value idea is, I guess, my answer to your question.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think a lot of people won't be able to get comfortable with that. And they're not going to be good fits for advisors, because they'll be wanting or needing to see the, what exactly did you do for me this month, this quarter, this year? In which case, our types of practices simply aren't going to work. You know, then maybe a pure hourly shop or something would be more appropriate for that, you know, for that scenario.
Absolutely.
All right. What are your go-to content sources for retirement planning, financial planning, tax planning, podcasts, blogs, books, formal education, you know, whatever it might be?
So I'm sure everyone who's been on here has mentioned Michael Kitsis. I love his blog. I read a lot of information from him. Conferences. I like David Kelly over at JP Morgan for economics. I like Ian Bremmer for global political. But I'll be honest, a lot, you know, I've been doing this for a long time now, networking with other advisors and, you know, having those relationships really does help for staying on top of things and researching. I also get tons of information from, you know, the account reps that I work with, the software that I subscribe to. So I do think we have access to a lot of information that's not necessarily generally commercially available. And unfortunately, that's where most of my knowledge comes from.
Yeah. And so we first met a couple of years ago. I think we ran across each other on, I don't know, LinkedIn maybe. And more recently, I think those listening may or may not have remembered, like I'm a member along with a handful of other advisors of this monthly group where we meet virtually. Lauren has since joined us a handful of months back, and it's been great. Glad to have you. Hopefully you're getting a lot out of it. But to your point, it really is hard to measure the value, because it's invaluable, of having a network of other advisors you can ask questions to, you know, vent to, whatever, and learn from. It's been great. So
I would say having a network of advisors has absolutely completely improved my ability to be an advisor, right? Because different, we can't all have dealt with every situation, right? And so having people to brainstorm with, or to double check, you know, is there another option here with, you know, obviously, well, not sharing client details, but just high level, help me think through this. In your knowledge and your practice, have you seen this before? How did you implement it? Is really valuable. And it just really helpful in helping with client situations as well, like on different stuff points.
Definitely. And so for everyone listening who may be concerned about, why would I want to hire someone who's a solo operation or a small operation? You know, this is how we help get over the, we don't work for a place with 3,000 individuals where we just have this endless amount of resources and other departments to go to. We rely on other advisors, other networking groups, other professional associations, et cetera. So ultimately, I mean, we have access to the same brain power and information. It's just, we need to take it upon ourselves to make sure we foster those connections and networking, which you and I clearly do. And you know, I'm glad to have cross paths, and especially now that you're in the group, it's been great.
No, it's been a really, really fun group. So yeah, I would say the other place that we get resources, right? Like, and I'm sure this is true, like I have a network of estate attorneys that I've worked with, or CPAs that I've worked with, right? So I'm able to tap the knowledge of other expert professionals, and I'm sure you're doing the same thing, right? That's the other knowledge source.
Yeah. And this sort of ties into the next like practice specific questions. There's going to be some products or things that you and I can't or don't directly sell or do, not because they're not important, just because you can't be all things to all people. So having an expert network of those who do specialize in doing this, selling that, whatever, is definitely important. Okay. So now specific to your practice, how do you know if someone is a good fit for you as opposed to just like you being a good fit for them?
So this is a really great and interesting question. So for me, a lot of it at this point is gut and having talked to a lot of people and worked with a lot of people. But what the people I find are best fits for my practice is I really do like to sort of get to the bottom of things. And so I ask my clients a lot of questions to really help them think through it. And so people who enjoy that type of dynamic or sort of like, let's puzzle this out relationship are a great fit for me. Someone who wants me to come in and tell them exactly what to do is not a great fit for me. I think a lot of the industry is built like that, but that's just not how I work with my clients.
Yeah. Any sort of, we already sort of discussed like people who are in or near retirement, but that aside, any sort of preference or stronger desire to work with certain personality types over others? And I have like engineers in mind. A lot of people either really love or really dislike working with engineers. Like, where do you stand in sort of client personality types?
So my clients tend to be very pragmatic, very down to earth, very like, you know, the world changes and we just kind of adjust with it. And so help me think through like, okay, where are we today? What can we put in place that's most likely to get us here tomorrow? And like, if we need to change it, we will. Like, let's just keep having a conversation about what changes. My clients tend not to be engineer types that want to dig into all those details. They tend to want me to help them understand their options, to, you know, be the technical expert and saying these two or three things might fit. Here's my general recommendation, but I'm giving you the information to make the final decision. Because I really do believe in the end, it's their money, it's their life, right? It's my job to educate, to help them understand the goals, the risks, like how it might play out. But I do ultimately let most of the final decisions be my clients. And so if you don't want that, then that's the other way you're not really a great fit for my practice.
And it's great that you make that clear, because I think a lot of people out there do want, like, just tell me if I'm okay and just tell me what to do. Like, I don't care. I don't want to know about anything else, right? And some advisors are completely okay with that. Some probably prefer that. It's clear you don't, which I'm not saying is bad, but it's great to set that expectation up front that if that's what people are looking for, like, don't do that. But those that want to be involved and be educated and pragmatic, great choice of words. And it's important to know it is always ultimately client's decision, whether it comes to doing a trade or making a broader financial planning decision.
Yeah.
We're just there to give the guidance, give input, give pros and cons, et cetera. Now, granted, some things will be actually outsourced, like the trading itself, right? You know, you're doing that, but
I'm doing that. Yeah.
But otherwise, I think people should, consumers listening should keep in mind, it is ultimately your decision. We're just here to help you make it is probably the right way to think about it. So.
Absolutely. That's my approach as well.
Okay. Next one. Have you ever had to, I'll say fire a client. It's not a great terminology, but have you ever voluntarily chosen to part ways with a client? If so, why, if you're comfortable sharing?
Sure, I have. And it was as my practice evolved and my business model changed, they were just no longer best served by my business model and my area of focus. And so even though I very much enjoyed them and we had a great relationship, I helped them find an advisor that really focused in the specialty, you know, the area of planning that they were much younger and not as close to retirement. And we parted saying, I hope we can come back and work together again, you know, as our, you know, life and models are more aligned. And so we have a great relationship. It just I helped them find a better fit for where they were in life.
That's great. And I think it's good when advisors realize, sorry, client XYZ, but I'm not the best for you for whatever reason. There's other advisors that'll take anyone who can fog up a mirror, which isn't a great sign. So being intentional and really limiting your services to those that you can best serve and are best served by you makes sense. Now, it doesn't mean the breakup, for lack of a better word, is easy or welcomed by the other party. But at the end of the day, I think it really is in their best interest. And as long as you're thoughtful and professional and ideally help them, like you said, find someone else, that's a win for everybody as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I do hope they come back around. You know?
Right. And they might. Exactly. And they'll appreciate you that much more when they do, right? Like the goodwill you built up and the right way you went about it is, that's never going to go away for them, right? So I'm sure they'll always remember you in a positive light for a long time because of that.
Thank you.
All right. Investment management. This, you can go a lot of ways with this, but what's your view and approach with investment management within your firm?
So without getting too caught in the weeds, I'm an asset allocator, which means that I pay a lot of attention to, if we say at the highest level, stocks versus bonds, right? And what that mix is and what my clients, what I'll call like risk tolerances or like what they want that mix to be. So I spend a lot of time with my clients up front picking, I jokingly call it, what roller coaster ride do we want to be on, right? 100% stocks is a much more adult coaster than 40% stocks. And so once I help my clients, you know, pick the right mix for them, it's about keeping it in balance and rebalancing back to those higher level asset allocation targets. I do use more than just stocks and bonds, but I think for the purpose of this conversation, it's the best way to think about it.
Okay. And are you able to give a little more detail, like within stocks,
sort of
active versus passive? You don't have to disclose your whole whatever, but a little bit broader strokes here.
Sure. I could talk about this forever if you really want to. I'm a big believer in nobody knows what's going to outperform tomorrow. So I use a lot of like the DFA, dimensional fund advisor methodology, which is let's buy the entire market and tilt into the factors that have been shown to outperform over long periods of time. Okay. Those factors being small over large, stocks over bonds, my favorite, profitable companies over unprofitable companies, value over growth. And so we're still buying everything. We still own the biggest companies, but we lean into the things that over time, over long periods of time, are more likely to outperform. I guess I should have said this at the beginning. I'm big on long-term investing from an asset management perspective. I'm not looking to make daily, weekly, quarterly changes to people's accounts. I'm helping them select funds that I think and hope we can hold for a very, very long time. From the bond perspective, I'm big on total return. I keep going.
Right. Well, you come from, you mentioned Citadel, one of the world's largest hedge funds and objectively one of the best at what they do, which is institutional investment management, of all flavors of asset classes. I mean, a lot of it's stocks and bonds, but they do some other kind of funky stuff. So it's interesting to hear from someone who came from the institutional world and truly knows this more detailed, more intimately than a lot of advisors. I'm not knocking them, but a lot of people learn investment management through training and have some exposure to it, but to really come from it gives you a different appreciation for what goes into it. And so it's interesting to hear your thoughts about that. So,
yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, especially as everything has become electronic and, you know, the information is out there, right? And so the idea that I have, you know, in my office in Hinsdale, more information about which stock is going to outperform than the traders who spend hundreds and hundreds of hours researching it over at Citadel. I'm not even really convinced. I'm a big believer that nobody really knows what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Nobody knew the coronavirus pandemic was going to happen, right? There's just always things that you can't predict. Being diversified at all times in an appropriate mix for you, to me, is the best outcome. But the idea that a consumer is going to, you know, out information, for lack of a better term, people who do this all day, every day, is interesting to me. Just
right.
Seems unrealistic, actually.
Yeah. And I feel the same. Like, I don't mean it to belittle people or say, don't even bother. But part of me is like, don't even bother. There are people who spend their careers, tens of hours a week focusing on all sorts of information, publicly available, not publicly available, There's no way the average person who's just reading stuff online is ever going to have an information edge to the quote unquote professionals. Doesn't mean you can't do better than them. But if you do, don't attribute it to you had this insightful knowledge that no one else did. It's you got lucky. Like, let's be honest, you know? So, or such is my view.
I'm with you. A little bit of luck sometimes.
Exactly. So I suspect I know the answer to this, but do you do any sort of benchmarking of your portfolios, your clients' portfolios, returns versus some index or benchmark and, you know, formally report to them that stuff?
I do. And I actually think benchmarks are really important expectation setting tools. So I find the average consumer is constantly trying to compare their portfolio to the S&P 500 because that's what's on cable news and that's what's out there. But most clients don't actually only own the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. So their idea that their portfolio should perform lockstep with it is just a little bit misguided. And so what I use custom benchmarking to do is just like, okay, if we're going to have a 70-30 portfolio, and again, I'll do this at the highest level, well, then I need a benchmark that has 70% stocks and 30% bonds to understand how my portfolio should have performed. So then I can look at my portfolio and say, did it do what I expected? Mm-hmm. And if it didn't, can I explain why? So for example, maybe like I also own international stocks and emerging market stocks in my portfolios. You know, if your benchmark only has US stocks and bonds, and I've got international and international did either better or worse, I should have some deviation from that performance, but I can explain it. I understand it. I'm comfortable with it. And if I can't explain it, understand it, and be comfortable with it, then I need to really look at my portfolio and, you know, dig a little bit deeper, see what's going on. So I do use benchmarks. I try when I can to use indexes. If those aren't available, I will use proxy ETFs. But yeah, I think it's important to compare apples to apples. So your portfolio to a comparable portfolio, just for expectation setting purposes. So my clients and I don't talk about it all the time, but at least once a year, it's like, hey, we did what we expected.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm doing what I told you we were going to do. Right. I kind of tell them like, that's your check on me. It should be pretty close.
Right. Do you use solely dimensional fund advisors, DFA funds for your funds, or do you use other things in the mix as well?
I use Dimensional. I use Avantis. I use a little bit of Vanguard. I use Prudential on the bond side, Dodge & Cox on the bond side. But Dimensional makes up the core of my, in the US, in the emerging, in the international. And then I layer in the others as needed.
Got it.
Depending on the size of the portfolio, how much money we have to invest, right? Because there's always this balance of like, I don't want to make three trades if one would do, right? Because that's one of the things I can control.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I know of a Dimensional. You know, have some of their funds, but do they produce or make available their own indices or like indices composites of their different funds or no?
I'm sure they do. From an indexing standpoint, I try to use the MSCI. I'll use the Russell 3000 on the US side, the MSCI Europe, Asia, Far East for developed, MSCI emerging markets, and then the Barclays Ag on the bond side. And then depending on if we have commodities or not, sometimes I throw the commodities index in there.
Yeah. So those are, to my knowledge, like those are the largest, most widely used and viewed indices for those respective asset classes. So, okay.
And that's like the goal, right? Like, let's try and say like, what is if we had to pick like just a baseline, like without tilting or preference, what would the baseline have been? And then how do I compare my portfolio to it?
Got it.
Appropriately.
Sure. Annuities. The A word. What is your view, usage, thoughts on annuities for clients?
So annuities are a tool and every tool has its place. But I find for my clients that I work with, it's very rarely the right fit. It tends to be very expensive and not really fit into just based on their life circumstances or where they are. So I don't use them very frequently. Mm-hmm. If people bring them into the relationship, I'll help them understand them. You know, we'll figure out keep, not keep. You know, it's not an automatic dump. But I'm not a huge fan, so I don't add them regularly.
Yeah. And I'm suspecting that the folks you work with, you said typically $2 to $10 million of assets or net worth.
Of net worth, yeah.
Yeah. In many, unless they have super high expenses to go along with that, like, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 a year of expenses, annuities probably don't make a lot of sense for that reason. It'd be more what's called a constrained investor, where there is much more real risk of them potentially outliving money, where annuities start to have more, I won't say legitimacy, that's a terrible word to use, but more meaningful impact to the plan and, you know, more suitability within the plan. So,
and that's a great way to say it. It is, like I said, a function of my client base. And I also would say my client base tend to be, and I call them diligent savers, but they're people who've accumulated their net worth because they've consistently lived below their means or built this, you know, business. And so exactly the way you explained it, there's just less constraints on what's likely to happen in their portfolio.
Sure.
From a spending perspective.
Got it. Next question, same thing for trust. What are your view, thoughts, usages around trust? I know you're not a lawyer. You don't draft and execute trust, but, and some of this is state specific, but, and I'm talking specifically now about like the living revocable trust, not some of the funky charity trusts or like special needs trust, but just a plain vanilla living revocable trust.
Trusts do end up fitting into my practice and my client base pretty often. And in fact, I think almost every one of my clients has put one in place. Now, some of that in Illinois, the state tax is much lower than the federal estate tax right now. So some of that is Illinois specific from a tax planning perspective. But also I find for clients that have homes in multiple states, it's a easy way to avoid probate in two states. Many of them like the privacy that comes with it. For some of them, it's about transferring assets legacy-wise to children or future generations. And so just for the client base that I am serving, trusts are often a part of our planning process.
Okay. And how many, like percentage-wise, whatever, of your clients happen to be in Illinois versus not?
So not as many as you would think. My clients have been scattered around the country. So I would say right now, 25 to 30% of my clients are in Illinois and everybody else is scattered. And that's just the way it has worked out. But in general, Illinois does have a significantly lower estate tax. So
yeah,
it's just kind of always been on my radar.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Long-term care and long-term care planning and insurance. This is something I always struggle with and frankly haven't come up with a great solution. Different circumstances warrant different recommendations, but what's your view and approach to helping clients manage this? And I suspect with large asset sizes, it might be self-fund is often the way to go, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. So how do you go about this with folks?
I have found this is very personal decision, client to client. And so the way I approach it is, this is how much you could spend out of your portfolio and, you know, theoretically not run out of money until you pass away at age 100, right? And so how does that potential spending compare to what long-term care would cost in a facility that you would want to live in? If one person ended up in that facility and you're part of a couple, would there still be enough for the remaining spouse to continue to live their life, or would they maybe be struggling a little bit? Could you both end up there and still cover the costs, right? And so once we kind of look at it from like what's possible from our spending, then it becomes that conversation kind of like you mentioned of, do we want to self-insure this risk? Do we want to outsource some of this risk? One of the other conversations I'm regularly having with clients is, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing decision, right? Maybe you want to insure part of the risk. You know, there's nothing wrong with insuring half the cost if you don't really want to self-insure the full, you know. So it is very personal. I find that this is an area of planning that people come into with very strong opinions about based on their own personal lived experiences. And this kind of goes back to that point you and I were saying before, where ultimately, it is their decision, right? So it's my job to help them understand that the long-term care market has changed. You can get pure long-term care. You can get long-term care packaged with life insurance, you know, like, and help them understand their options and understand what their spending could support relative to the cost of care in their area. And then it's their choice. Every once in a while, it's tight. And I'll say, you know, if it were me, I might consider X. But it's really more about education than like telling what to do here. It is a tough one, though, because you don't really, you don't know if you'll need it. You don't know if you'll ever qualify to use it. But I do find people, do you find that people come with very strong opinions? I do find that people.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And some because personal experience, like, you know, whatever, my uncle had it and it was a nightmare trying to get the insurance company to actually pay for anything. So I'm never going to buy it. Or on the flip side, other people, I was like, yeah, you know, my uncle had it and it was the best thing ever. And he's been in long-term care for 8 years and it's still paying or something like that. And then everything in between. But I like what you said about it doesn't need to be all or none, because if you're trying to fully insure, especially like a worst case scenario of like 4 or 5 years of, you know, $100,000+ a year of expenses, you're going to choke at what, if you can even get the policy, you're going to choke at what the cost is. Yeah. And it's probably going to go up, you know, 20% every other year. But maybe you just get some coverage to kind of take the edge off and just help shield some, not shield, but help protect some of your assets from being spent that much more on it. And that can be more palatable and sort of a nice mix in between as opposed to being all or none.
Yeah. And the other thing I generally tell consumers is I think inflation riders are really important on long-term care policies, right? Because, you know, you're much more likely to use it further out in your lifespan from the point that you buy it. So, you know, definitely explore or at least research what the inflation riders would cost you. And then, it's a tough one. It is expensive. And the other thing I would tell consumers is if you commit to buying a long-term care policy, you probably want to be committed.
Right.
Because I feel like I've seen people get a few years in and then it's like, ooh, this is real expensive and painful, but you're that much closer to potentially needing it at that point.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting product.
It's hard without knowing the future, which none of us do, obviously. Like those who do have a long-term care event and could benefit from a policy, if you do have a policy, you'll be exceptionally glad you have it. I guess like any form of insurance, right? Like, I guess the goal is that you actually don't want to use it. You know, it shouldn't feel like a win when you do have death or long-term care or whatever. But for better or worse, I think that is a lot of the way people sort of view the insurance analysis, especially when it comes to long-term care. It's like, I'm not going to get anything for it, so I'm not going to buy it, which I get where you're coming from. It's human nature, but it's like, I don't know if that's the right way to frame it. So
I'm curious, do you find that people sometimes misunderstand, because I see this, the difference between long-term care needs and like moving to a retirement facility? So long-term care is like when you can't necessarily hit those areas of daily living. And sometimes I think people think they're buying insurance for like the cost of moving into a retirement facility. Mm-hmm. And those are not the same thing. So that's the other conversation I feel like I have with my clients.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's not just, you know, hey, I struggle to get up the steps, so long-term care is going to cover me, right? Like, no, it's very tightly defined. You need to be able to not do at least 2 out of 6 activities of daily living. And they're substantial. It's feeding, bathing, you know, getting up and down from the toilet. And I forget what the other ones are.
Medication, I think.
Is that okay?
With medication.
And so like that, it's 2 of those. It's not just one. So like you have to not be able to do 2 of those. That's real big difference from I struggle with getting upstairs. And I'm not downplaying the severity of not being able to go up and downstairs, but it's a significant difference. So it's important to know like what it's really going to take for this long-term care insurance to be invoked. It's going to be a pretty bad scenario.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Distribution plans. This was a lot of these were crowdsourced questions, but
okay.
What is your process and approach for putting in place a distribution plan for clients in retirement?
And I'm assuming here you mean like the actual technicality of like, I've got this big pot of assets saved and now I want to distribute it to clients. So
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So like every question I think that we've talked about, it's all, you know, client specific of what types of assets do we have. I have definitely seen people where almost all of their assets is in a large 401k plan, and that distribution plan means most of them are coming out of the 401k plan. But you know, this is a little bit where I think that tax planning comes into play of, is there certain years where I'm going to be in a lower tax bracket where I might want to pull from taxable income? And I'm thinking I have a few clients who have, you know, pensions or other things where their tax bracket is going to change over time. If there are none of those considerations, I tend to use the classic, you know, taxable account or brokerage first, IRA or 401k second, and Roth last. But again, my plan is adjusted based on what we have and what the rules are at the time.
Yeah, makes sense. So it depends is the answer.
Always.
And then this was another specific question from someone in the Facebook group, was the deliverable around it. So someone asked, like, okay, I hire an advisor, he or she is going to put together this plan for me. Like, what do I actually get showing or telling me what to do and how to distribute money, where to take account, which accounts take money from throughout the years? What's your deliverable, if anything, look like with regards to that?
So because I am managing the assets, I really do help set up the distributions, right? So we'll go in and we're going to take this much from this account this month, and it's going to link it to your checking account and it's going to get transferred. And it's my job to make sure that the cash is there. You know, the way I approach this is I set 12 to 18 months worth of cash aside in retirees' portfolios so that we're not beholden to what's happening in the market, right? Mm. And when that gets down to 8 or 9 months worth of cash, I rebalance and raise. But, you know, that transfers out of the accounts that we have talked about in the order that we talked about. So I would say my deliverable is more the conversations that happened before of how much can you spend? How much do you think you need and want to spend, right? And once we've like settled up what that's going to be, okay, now where are we going to pull it from? Let's set up the distribution, whether I do it on your behalf or you log into Schwab and, you know, key it in yourself.
Yeah.
Been on Zoom calls where I help people do that too, that if they want, you know, that control. Mm-hmm. And that is the distribution plan. If somebody wanted something very specifically typed out, I would create it for them, but I don't have clients asking me for that. That is the point that my clients are like, okay, we've made the decision. Now you go do your thing.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that at the end. I think that's people who don't know what a good advisory planning relationship looks like, aren't sure what to expect. Like, what do I get in retirement? How do you help me actually use and spend this, or, you know, distribute this money? And I think until you go through the process for a year or so with a good planner and realize it is this sort of living dynamic thing where, yes, you mechanically, you know, you learn, set up the distributions, you free up the cash, et cetera. I think then people get comfortable with, okay, I see how this is going to work going forward. I don't feel the need to have something typed out that shows the next 20 years in painstaking detail about what's going to happen every year. But it's hard to say that to someone. It's almost like you'll know it when you see it after you go through it, like what you get and what you don't, which isn't a great answer, but I don't know if there's a better way to sort of describe it for people.
No, and I agree with you. And to be honest, like if you're trying to map it out 20 years out, you can pretty much only guarantee that that's not going to happen, right? Something will change, the rules will change, their life will change, and that is not what will happen. You know, if you're anything more than 12 to 18 months out, I think maybe it's a educated guesstimate of what will happen or a model or a projection, but I wouldn't look at it like fact.
Yeah, agreed. So next one, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask a tax planning question in this podcast. So again, this was another kind of crowdsourced question, but what are some common tax planning opportunities you come across with your clients?
So for my clients, we do the Roth conversions, the asset location of like, because I'm a householder, meaning I don't buy the same funds in every account. Mm-hmm. I try to create that broader, you know, asset mix across different accounts based on different type. So asset location. For my pre-retirees, sometimes it's about which account we're contributing to actually, as we're tax planning on the back end of where we want the dollars to end up. But those are the big ones that come across in my practice. There are some other client specific things, but for the most part, those are the big ones that I see regularly.
Got it. Makes sense. How do you, so a lot of what we do could be very technical, very in the weeds, and we do, as advisors, do need to pay attention to the details, obviously, but it's easy to let the details get too present and sort of consume things. So how do you help clients balance getting detail, getting specific, but not getting unnecessarily complicated and cumbersome in the plans and the recommendations?
So I love to work backwards, actually. I like to look at, like, where are we trying to go? And then what are the levers that we need to put in place to get there? So it's my job to understand the technical details, but I really only bring to the table, like, these are the two or three options that we need to look at right now to keep us moving in the direction that we want to go. And I tend to, in my practice, try to focus on one, I'm going to call it planning area at a time. So we're going to spend today on investments and just talk about that. Because I think if you try to present too much or too long, it's just overwhelming. It's too much. And at that point, maybe you're not making the best decisions. Maybe it's an exhausted decision. So I tend to start with where are we going and then present the pieces that I think are most important at that moment to get there.
Yeah. That's a good way to view it. If you don't know where you're going, you don't know how to get there.
That's my plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been doing this though for as long as I can remember. When I would get stuck on tests, even growing up, I would flip over to the back and start at the last question.
Right. Oh, I like
just
it.
A little bit how I think about problems.
Sounds like it should be like a motivational saying on a t-shirt or something. Like, you don't know where you're going. How do you get there? Whatever. I don't know.
That's kind of.
I thought I had a moment of brilliance there trying to equate that to something else, but I realized I don't know what I'm saying, so I'll just move on.
Fair.
All right. How do you know, or how do you help your clients determine if they have, quote unquote, enough? And this is always a tough one, largely sort of emotional and subjective, but do you see any commonalities in approaches or things you can do with people to determine if they have, if and when they have enough?
So I think one of the other interesting things about our industry in general is that we try to make things black and white, enough or not enough. And I think that there's actually a lot of gray. And so I tend to approach this problem of, this is what I've put together. So this is like my pile of assets, for lack of a better way of explaining it. And what could, if I wanted to die with my last penny in my pocket at age 100 or whatever age we agree upon in our conversation, how much could I spend? And how does that compare to what I'm spending today or what I know I want to spend in the future? And then once we have those two numbers, sometimes it's very clear, like, oh, I can spend $500,000 and I want to spend $100,000, and I'm picking extreme numbers, like, okay, we're good. If it comes out, I can spend $250,000 and I think I want to spend $260,000, right? Then we're having different conversations. If obviously the numbers are reversed the other way, it's a different, but then it's like, okay, what levers can we change? If I've seen people say, hey, I was actually grossing out my retirement spending from what I'm spending today because I want to go on a bunch of vacations. Like, maybe I actually don't want to do that and I do want to retire today. You know, like, maybe this number over here is actually too high. Or maybe it's, I just need to work a few more years so that I can, like, add just a little bit of padding. For some people, it's, maybe I'm going to work part-time for a few years and ease into the transition. I'm very fortunate in that very few of my clients is it ever very outsized, you know, the opposite way. I absolutely need to spend $150,000 for living, for groceries, for, you know, just basic living needs. And I can spend 80. It's not usually that way for my clients, but I do think approaching the problem by what can I do and what do I want to do often provides a lot of clarity on, like, what the right next step is.
Okay. And those that do have enough but struggle to actually spend, even after going through discussions with them and showing them all the, you know, the objective reasons why it's okay, how do you help get people over that hurdle to start decumulating their nest eggs?
So it's a lot of conversations, but I think this is where the interpersonal dynamic is really important, and, like, really knowing your client and understanding what is their fear about spending. Is it the fear that I'm going to run out of money? Because then maybe we're regularly checking in, you know, once a year on what does that number look like? Hey, you can still spend $500 and you're spending $150, you know, like, and just kind of them getting used to the conditioning of, like, oh, okay, it's going to be okay. If the real fear is, I'm really afraid I'm going to retire tomorrow and the market might crash and I'm going to lose half my portfolio, you know, then maybe I'm presenting something. Well, what would happen if your portfolio took it? You know, like, it's about understanding what's really driving the fear of spending, yeah, and creating a deliverable that helps them over the hurdle? And I know that's a little bit of a cop-out answer, but I don't think everyone's fear of spending is the same. I will say that in making my transition from, you know, leaving my salary job to starting my firm, I have a whole new appreciation for just how scary the transition can be. But I find that once people are in it and living it, kind of like you said about the planning process, they do get more comfortable with it. It's really about that 6 months or a year right before they make the transition that I see the most fear around that particular question.
Yeah. And it's hard to, you got to sort of walk delicately around that. It's easy to say, you're fine. This just shows you're fine. Go ahead and spend. Like, easier said than done, right? You have to have appreciation for them, where they're coming from, especially if they just spent 40 years accumulating, working, always having a paycheck. And now that stops. Like, that could be tremendously jarring to the system. So we can just give as much assurance as we can and not be like a bully about telling them, don't be silly, go spend. You know, it's not that simple.
No, and I think that's like one of those points that you're having more conversations with people, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to continue to talk about this, like, let's continue to talk about it. Let's make sure you're comfortable before you make the decision. And I think sometimes for people, what drives this decision is they don't know what they're retiring to, right? Of like, what comes next? And if I've actually sometimes referred to people work with like retirement coaches and stuff, like, I guess what I'm saying is I've found that the driver for this fear is so different. Yeah. Sometimes it's just, what am I going to do with my dad?
Yeah. Which is hard. I mean, that's a legit question and concern for people. What am I going to do with my day? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's important to retire to something, not just from something. You really do have to think through, what's this going to look like? What do I want to do? What's my new purpose and meaning going to be, to the extent I'm losing a lot of purpose and meaning, if, you know, if my purpose and meaning was tied up in my job. So for clients that don't have enough, how do you help them deal with that, tweak that, change plans or expectations, et cetera?
So I think it depends by how far off of enough is, right? And really it's about, how did we come to our number of like what we want to spend? Like, is that based on exactly what we're spending today? And we're pretty sure nothing in our lifestyle is going to change. And like, how then far off is that from what we hope to spend in the future? And then it's really just about helping them identify the levers that are available to them to adjust or to pull. So again, for some people, here's what's possible, but if you worked 2 more years and contributed this and this, like, here's what's possible. For some people, I guess the worst case scenario is we have to reduce our spending today to set different expectations for retirement. And that kind of has a double benefit, right? We're spending less and we're getting used to living on less, so we need less. So that's like the biggest lever if you absolutely, you know, have a mismatch of what's possible and what we have. But it's really just about trying to bring those things back in balance.
Yeah. And everyone's balance and tolerance to get back to balance is going to be a little different, which makes this all challenging.
Well, and I think it was Morningstar who first started talking about like that retirement smile, where people spend more in their early years and then the spending kind of fades off. And then if you have a health issue, it starts to creep back up. So the other conversation that I sometimes have around, you know, this is the number you're presenting is like your need to spend based on healthy us early in retirement doing a lot? Or is this based on, this is what I need to pay my mortgage, buy my grocery, you know, like, the more core living expenses. And if it is the first one, well, how might that change over time? Because I can tell you, when my grandfather was 97, he was not, you know, traveling internationally.
Right. Yeah. You may or may not have your reduced discretionary expenses backfilled in part or in full by medical expenses or, you know, other related living expenses. But it's inevitable, right? Mind and body will slow down and you're not doing much aggressive activities, travel, hobbies, et cetera, over time. So all else equal, assume spending will decline from that. All right, wrapping up here. If you can give only one piece of advice or word of wisdom to listeners about retirement planning, what would it be? And note, this is directed toward consumers, not advisors, because there are a lot of advisors who listen to this.
So this is a really tough one. There's lots of advice I'd love to give, but I ultimately think my piece of advice would be control what you can control. So you can control how disciplined you are about your investments. You cannot control what happens in the market tomorrow. You can control how much, you know, you take out of your portfolio. You can control your spending. So if there is a market, you know, pullback, maybe that's the year that you pull back your spending a little bit to give more time for recuperation, right? You can't control if you have a health insurance, but you can't, like a health issue later, but you can control whether you're choosing to offset that risk with insurance, right? So just remaining focused on what you can control and tuning out the noise, because I think there's a lot of noise and clickbait that tries to focus consumers on things that they actually have zero control over.
So you're basically, all of CNBC is like that, is my opinion.
Basically, just turn it off.
Yep. Yep. CNBC, turn off the TV, close the boy browser, just don't pay attention. All right. This is great. Now, where can people go to find out more about you, your firm, et cetera?
Yeah. So you can visit my website, which is www.daybreak-wealth.com. You can push the Let's Connect meeting to book a meeting. I love to hear people's stories. I think the best way to learn is for us to have a conversation. But you can also call me at the phone number listed on my website or shoot me an email. It's lauren@daybreak-wealth.com.
Excellent. Well, Lauren, this was a lot of fun, a lot of great information, very good perspectives about lots of things. So thank you for coming on and sharing your time and knowledge.
Yeah, thanks for having this conversation. It was fun.
All right. Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
And scene. So concludes my talk with Lauren Hunt from Daybreak Wealth Management. Great chat. Hope you all enjoyed it. I know I did. It's always interesting to hear other people's, you know, practitioners' perspectives and views on these questions. I always learn something from it. I hope you all listening pick a little something up too. If nothing else, that there's no one single way, right way, best way to view, to do, to approach any of this stuff. There's some commonalities, obviously, and there's, you know, things that should be avoided in some clear-cut cases, but people's views and best practices towards certain things could all be slightly different. And so it's really sort of enlightening and refreshing to hear different perspectives on how to approach all this stuff. All right, that's that. I hope you enjoyed this. And as always, if you haven't, I would greatly appreciate if you take a few moments to leave a review on Apple iTunes or whatever other podcast listening platform you may use to ingest and listen to this gem of a podcast. And also check out the retirementplanningeducation.com website, which is sort of the centralized hub for the retirement planning education brand of content I put out, which is this podcast. There's a Facebook group by the same name, YouTube channel by the same name. There's a monthly blog, and there's a whole host of freely downloadable checklists, flowcharts, summaries, and other helpful stuff where you can just click and download. There is no lead capture, as they say in the sales world, where you have to cough up your name or phone number, email. Just click download and there you have it. Hope you enjoy it. Well, that's that. Thank you as always for listening, and I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.